So welcome to the Sunday night There is a Solution newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Our speaker today is a compulsive overeater and a member who has at least 6 months of abstinence, has recovered through the directions in the Big Book, and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program on what the speaker has shared. Welcome, Deborah M., a compulsive overeater from Southern California. Good evening, Deborah. The floor is yours.
Thanks so much. Wow, I heard that introduction and I'm looking around. Who's she? Who's that you're talking about that has all those things? You mean I have this and I have this and I have, and I'm like, oh, okay. You know, and I do, and it's by the grace of God and the fellowship of Overeaters Anonymous, one day at a time, one step at a time. I want to thank Dovia who texted me this afternoon. Speaker must have canceled or whatever. And she's like, I'm sorry, it's late notice. And I was like, and I'm like, I realized that I had just been to World Service Conference. I have my granddaughter and my stepdaughter and all the family were coming and then we were going to a buffet for lunch and blah. So I thought it might be a really good idea to talk. And so I said, yes. I said, how can I support my recovery? And supporting my recovery was by being here. I'm sorry, a chat just came in and distracted me. So like I said, my name is Deborah. I am a compulsive overeater, vomiter, and drug addict, recovering one day at a time through the grace of God and the fellowship of both Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the mother program of our program of OA. I walked into my first OA, and there are some people who have heard this before. I see some smiles. It's sort of the way I always start because it reminds me of where I am. And I want to welcome Doug. I don't know if you have any experience in other 12-step programs, but I was always taught that you are the most important person in the room. If I don't give away to the newcomer the gift that I have so graciously given, I don't get the privilege of keeping it. And my life is really good right now, and I'm just selfish enough to want to keep it. So I'm willing to take directions and give it away to you. So we are really glad you're here. And we hope that you hear something that you like. And if you don't hear anything that resonates for you, please go to a few more meetings and before you give it up. And when I first started coming in, they said to me, try 6 meetings. If you don't like what you've found here, we'll cheerfully refund your misery. I knew what it was like before, and I don't want that again. And I know what it's like now. And I'm sorry, there's a little background noise. It's a video of my granddaughter. It's gone now. It's on one of those picture frames that circles picture, whatever. It was a 75th birthday present for my husband, a gift, who is also a gift of my recovery. At any rate, I walked into my first Overeaters Anonymous meeting, May 15th, 1981, which is 43 years ago in 2 days now. And I like to say that the only two things that I did right were that I kept breathing and I kept coming back. Okay. Everything else took me a really, really long time to get. And like I said, I apologize to some friends of mine who are here because they've already heard this again, but it helps me to remember that. And it took me 9 years of coming to OA meetings. And I'm not talking about just coming one time, thinking all you people are crazy and going away and coming back a year later. I'm talking about 2, 3, 5 meetings a week, 2 trips through different eating disorder units, being sent off to a women's long-term recovery program. And I still didn't get it. It took me 9 years of being here to have the abstinence that I celebrated just last It was April 23rd. I celebrated 34 years of continuous abstinence, one day at a time. And I have pictures. So just to let you know that I really qualify, I stand a little over 5 feet tall, and my top weight was about 185 pounds. And so this is kind of what I looked like in 1973. And I actually have the hard copies of those photos because we used to pass those photos around at meetings, and it was like, this is what I look like. Let's see if I can get this thing to go down. Okay. And in 1970, and shortly afterwards, I joined Weight Watchers. And Weight Watchers did a great job. And it was the first time I ever had gotten on a meal plan, first time I'd ever actually dieted. And I lost a lot of weight, but it didn't change my head and it didn't change my thinking as a compulsive overeater. Because what happened was that the original Weight Watchers program allowed you a lot of what they called unlimited foods. So I would eat my, 6 ounces of protein for dinner and 4 ounces of protein for lunch and my 2 eggs for breakfast and whatever. And I lost weight, but I also ate 6 heads of lettuce and 4 pounds of broccoli because I'm a volume eater. And I just ate and ate and ate. So my behavior didn't change. And when I eventually started, and I learned how to throw up in the college dorm. And it wasn't like, oh, this is the panacea, I'm going to be skinny forever. It was like something that I did just once in a while when I accidentally overate. And then it grew. So what happened was I lost all that weight, and I identify as a compulsive overeater, vomiter, and a drug addict because I found cocaine. And cocaine let me get really thin. And so there I was compulsively eating. And got very thin from the cocaine. And like I said, I joined Overeaters Anonymous in 1981, which is when this picture was taken. So I came into this program and I was, my body weight was a normal, healthy body weight, but I was an absolutely crazy person. And I was chasing that weight. I chased it every day. And if the number on the scale wasn't the right number, I wouldn't go out that day. And I would chase, it was like, it had to be right. And it had to be the right number. So that's part of my story, the ups and the downs in terms of my weight. And I like to show these two pictures, which is a fast forward in my recovery. I didn't do dating very well. I don't know if anyone else can relate to that. So when I was about 16 years abstinent, my sponsor said to me, you're clean, you're sober, you're abstinent, your relationships with other human beings stink. You need to go to Al-Anon. So I started an Al-Anon program where I learned how to deal with other human beings. And at a party in December of Christmas Eve 2000, I met somebody who became my husband. And the reason we have these two pictures together, so the picture on the right is from 2020, and this picture was recently taken in 2023. And yes, I'm actually wearing the exact same outfit, and including the same skirt. I think the stockings are different, but so I have maintained my weight, and we have traveled all over the world. One of these pictures, this is the one on the left, was in London just before, both of these were just before the pandemic, and the other one was in Paris. And so I've traveled around the world abstinently, and that's a gift of recovery that I get from this program. So my story and picture is bottom and top. This is what my big book looks like. One of my big books looks like, is it's in a lot of pieces, and it's in a lot of pieces, and because it gets opened a lot. Fortunately, I have a number of other copies, but I like to show this one because how broken up it actually became from all its use and all its being open to find out how to recover from this seemingly, and I love that word, seemingly hopeless case of mind, body, and spirit, a disease of mind, body, and spirit. It is seemingly hopeless. It's not hopeless. I am powerless over food, but I am not helpless. And I learned that here. And if I stop at the I am powerless, it's like, oh, well, I'm just going to be this way. This is the way I'm going to be for the rest of my life. This, but I'm not helpless. I have to know that I am powerless. I pick up the first one of fill in the blank and I'm off to the races. I cannot start. It is like getting in the boxing ring with Muhammad Ali. I don't know if any of you made multiple trips to the grocery store in one day. Like, you know, like you eat all the food and then wait, I got to go back again because of XYZ and I'm back there again and back there again. Well, at the end of the checkout counters or before you start checking out, there's all the magazines they're trying to sell you or they want you to buy or spontaneous. And a lot of those magazines on the cover says, lose 10 pounds if, and this new diet, and take this quiz and find out if you're this and that, and why he doesn't like you, and why you're getting fired for a job. And the magazines are telling you that there's a solution. Like, here's a solution. Buy this magazine, open this up, do these things, and you're going to get solved. And I would like to share with you that, in my opinion, and I found this out in hindsight, there's a chapter in this book, and it's the second chapter, and it's called There is a Solution. I like to think of this as the original self-help book. This book tells me there is a solution. There is a solution to my mental twist and physical allergy. See, I have the in the doctor's opinion, Dr. Silkworth, first of all, and I know I'm jumping all over the place because I love this book so much, but in the doctor's opinion, and in my book, which is a third edition, it's on XXIII. He's writing that letter, that to whom it may concern letter from Dr. Silkworth. And he talks about that in late 1934, I attended a patient who, though he had been a competent businessman of good earning capacity, was an alcoholic of a type that I had come to regard as hopeless. And I had to learn to understand that the word hopeless meant out of ideas. I had to be out of ideas. I couldn't think one more time, maybe I'll try Dr. Stillman's diet. Maybe I'll try the pregnant urine woman's injections, shots, diet. Maybe the rub your ears, the acupuncture. One more fat farm. I did not have my jaws wired, but I know somebody who did. And, you know, I had to be out of ideas. Was I finally out of ideas? No more one good idea, because that brokenness allowed me to be put back together by this program. And I come here, and then it continues to tell me that there is a solution, which was not my idea. It's somebody else's solution. And sorry, there's a bug flight. And on page 24, they print in italics here on page 24. And it's my understanding that when, you know how when we type documents now, we can pick our font and we can italicize and we can underline and we can do all those things with all the word processing that we have now. But when the big book was set, it was hand typeset. And if you wanted italic letters, you had to actually pay more. And, you know, a bunch of early Alcoholics Anonymous, they were not an organization. They were a ragtag bunch of people who had come to this miraculous spiritual solution that they wanted to share with other people. And they had to pay extra to put this paragraph in italics. So my sponsor said to me, they really want you to pay attention to this paragraph. And this paragraph, which is on page 24, says, the fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. I don't know about any of you, but I had lost the power of choice. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. And if I read this in the first person, my so-called willpower had become practically non-existent. I didn't even have willpower to become non-existent, but it had become non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. I don't know about any of you. I was totally without the defense against the first drink. Honest to God, it's like getting in the boxing ring with Muhammad Ali. I am absolutely defenseless. I am on the mat every time. The almost certain consequences, and I don't know about you, but they could take the word almost out. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. That memory, especially of a bulimic, I didn't have a memory of 2 hours ago. I was back at the store again, apologizing to, well, not apologizing to the grocery, the cashier, saying, oh, you know, more people are coming over and I really need to get more stuff because there are more people than I expected. And there I am buying it again, more of the same stuff. Those thoughts did not crowd into my mind and deter me from 2 hours ago. And I am back there again. And then on the next page, again in italics, four little words, there is a solution. And they're going to tell me in this paragraph what the solution is. And, you know, this is in the beginning of the book. This is page 25. They haven't even talked about steps. They haven't even told you Bill's story about, you know, being in the cemetery at the church where he reads that tombstone that talks about the soldier that dies from being cold small beer, and that cold small beer was a special type of thing and special type of ale in England. I'm kind of babbling here, but you know, they haven't even told you about that. They're just setting the story up here, and they're already telling me that there's a solution, and hopefully that this is a solution is enticing enough that it'll lead me to do more of the actions that are asked of me in the big book. And it says here in this paragraph, almost none of us like the self-searching. Well, that self-searching, that would be a fourth step. The leveling of our pride, the confession of shortcomings. Well, that's steps, you know, step six, the confession of my shortcomings, which the process requires for its successful consummation. So it's telling me here is if I want to stay abstinent, if I want to keep getting the things that I've been so generously given by this program, it tells me that I have to keep doing these things. The process requires this. You know, I got abstinent a whole bunch of times in those first 9 years. I had 3 months at one point. At one point, I even had 3 years, but it was all white knuckle abstinence. It was all keeping the lid on the pressure cooker, keeping it down, keeping it down, keeping it down. And I wasn't really looking at my behaviors. I wasn't really being honest. I was still deceiving myself. You know, I was still in the how, what can I do just to get by? I wasn't I was still very selfish, self-centered, judgmental. I don't know, there's a couple other people here who could probably toss in a few things for me, you know. And you know, that pride goeth before a fall. Well, that was probably why I couldn't stay abstinent. You know, I couldn't let you in to know my dark side. You know, one of the things about being at a healthy body weight, one of the things about being this person, I'm going back to share screen again, one of the things about being this person who was thin but crazy, that is different from this person that's thin and reasonably sane, was that I lied. Because you see, this person who was doing cocaine and throwing up is really a grossly overweight 300-pound person walking around in a 110-pound body, which means I was a lie. I was a physical lie walking around. So if I couldn't present myself honestly in the world, I was always a fraud. I was always presenting you with somebody that I really wasn't. I was trying to be who I thought you wanted me to be so that maybe you would like me and not leave me. And I was always trying to figure that out. And it wasn't until I did this thing, which says the leveling of my pride, which is what is required for its successful consummation. I had to finally, it was like when the pain of eating became greater than the pain of what I was eating over, I began to be willing to not eat over things. And I couldn't do that alone. I'd spent years trying to do that alone. I was going to beat this. I was going to get the diet right. I was going to get the job. I was going to get my finally get my mother to like me, which, mind you, she died 2 years ago at the age of 100. And even then, I still think she's telling me I was doing it wrong when she was 90. She was 100 and I was still doing it wrong. You know, 70 whatever years old, and I'm still doing it wrong. Whatever. It didn't take me out the way it did anymore because I'd worked with a sponsor, because I'd done my inventory, because I'd made my amends. Whether she accepted, believed, whatever, that's her stuff. But on my side, I knew what I had done to clean my side of the street. And so I got to be abstinent. I continued to be able to live in the sunlight of the spirit. My life is a complete miracle. Okay. The very fact that at that party on December 24th, 2000, that I met somebody and we're still here together, literally almost 24 years later, is a complete miracle. My husband came with three daughters. So I have three stepdaughters and who actually like me. Well, two and a half of them do, but that she, the other one, I don't think she likes anyone. So again, you know, that one's not on me. And I have four grandchildren. I was at both of my stepdaughters' weddings. I actually walked down the aisle in one of them. Miracles. I couldn't have written a script like this. I couldn't have, you know, I had my 15-year-old grandson, and this is funny. The oldest grandson, who is 15, was born on our first wedding anniversary, like on the day. And believe me, my first thought was, really? 364 other days in the year, and you pick my first wedding anniversary to be born? Now, mind you, it took me longer to say that resentment than this resentment lasted. But it was like, really, really? And you know, now Jackson and I were really close. He called me to wish me a happy Mother's Day, happy Grandmother's Day today. How could I ever write a story that would have anything like that in it? It's just not part of my story. And yet it's my life today. And that's because I'm willing to say yes when I was like, oh, I don't want to talk this afternoon. I was at the OA World Service Business Convention in Albuquerque for the first time. I was never able to take a world service commitment before. I taught school. I taught elementary school. So the first week in May, you're coming up to the end of the school year, and that's not a time where you can say, bye, I'm taking a week off to go do something else. So I never was able to do it. And then we had a pandemic, and then I retired. So I was able to go to World Service Business Conference. And it was really quite remarkable to meet compulsive overeaters. And I don't know if anyone here has ever done this, but I met people. There was a whole delegation from Greece. I met a compulsive overeater from Poland, from the Ukraine, from, you know, Australia, from Croatia. Over 20 countries were represented. And I can't, it was like, it brings goosebumps when you think that we are all trying to do this thing. And we're all trying to do this. This is one of the things I like to show. I went to, my husband is also sober, and we were traveling and we went to a meeting in Australia. The big book in Australia is green, if you didn't know that. So I was like, they gave us a big book and I was like, whoa, it's green. And the first 164 pages are the same, but the stories are different. To be with recovering compulsive overeaters from all over the world and conduct the business of OA. It wasn't about just meetings and hearing people's recoveries. It's how does this program work? How do they decide on what days to have what things? How do they, and how do we support everyone? There were groups of people who didn't feel their voices were being heard. And the chair would stop the proceedings to be able to make certain their points were being taken. Now, whether their points were voted on as yes or no, that's a different story. But they were heard. I don't know about any of you. I was a middle child. I was never heard in my family. I was an invisible child. I didn't have a voice. We welcome you in Overeaters Anonymous. We are glad you are here. You have a voice here. Every single person in this room is helping me to stay abstinent one more day. And like I said, right now, I am just selfish enough to want to continue to have that abstinence. So I needed this meeting, believe me. You know, I was in Albuquerque for that week. It was all business meetings. And by the time they had, I'm one of the older people there. So when they were having, you know, let's have an OA meeting at 8:30 at night, I'm like, sorry, bedtime. You know, I've had it. So I haven't been to a meeting in a while. And so I was like, I needed this meeting. I may need to be here more than any of you need to be here. I may need to be hearing me say, I'm a recovering compulsive overeater and I don't eat one day at a time for me. I can't do anything about all of you. I hope that you, Doug, any other newcomers are willing to put the food down for just 10 more minutes. You know, just can I get through the next 10 minutes? God's there for me. See, my power, it's a miracle. I use the word God because it's convenient, it's easy. But your higher power can be whatever it is. It's like, I just need to know that it's not me. What I was really trying to lead up to the fact that my airplane that was supposed to get in to get to where I am from Palms, from Albuquerque, I had to fly to Phoenix and then Phoenix to Palm Springs. And it started off great. I fly from Phoenix to Albuquerque, from Albuquerque to Phoenix. My plane gets in. I look up on the board. My connecting plane leaves in about a half an hour. There was a woman with a white cane, needed a little direction. I walked her to where she's going, turn around and come back. My plane is suddenly leaving 2.5 hours later. And I just want to, for a 45 minute flight, I want to shoot myself. Okay. So my plane eventually landed last night at 12:30. Well, this morning, I finally got into bed at 12:30 this morning, and we live about 15 minutes from the airport. And then the grand family was coming over for this brunch at, there's a club on the property here where we live. And then she wanted to go, she's 4 years old, and she wanted to go swimming. So I'm like, can I go to bed now? You know? And this meal that we went to could be like a shipwreck for a compulsive overeater. It is just like any binge food that you could possibly imagine was there. And it was a buffet. So it wasn't like, oh, if I have that, that's more money. You know, it was like, I'm like, okay. So I eat my meal. I did get to take a doggy bag. I was like, can I take some locks home with me? And they were like, yes. And then my meal was over. That it was like, it's like a first order magnitude miracle that I'm not still there face down in the food. You know, how does that happen? That I feel like I've had enough. Because my enougher inside is completely broken. My enougher has to really be my visual now. Because I never feel full. I may be like stuffed to the gills, but I never feel full. It's a faith that I have gotten over the years. That thing the big book talks about, we recoil as if from a hot flame. I recoil as if from a hot flame because I am willing to remember the consequences of where that food will take me. I remember being in Chicago. I got abstinent in Chicago where it was 44 below zero on a New Year's Eve, New Year's Day morning. I had been to a New Year's Eve party the night before, had done a whole lot of cocaine. I don't even remember the food. My car started, it was 44 below zero. I went to back then. They're AMPs. There were AMPs then. I don't know if AMP even still exists. And on holidays then, when the stores were 24-hour markets, they would close at midnight and reopen at 6 a.m. I was sitting in the Dunkin' Donuts across the street at 5:30 in the morning, eating donuts, waiting for the grocery store to open. So I am a complete miracle. And I want to end with a little bit from Dr. Bob's Nightmare, which is on page 180 and 181, which talks about why he continued to do this. And he says here, "I spend a great deal of time passing on what I learned to others who want it and need it badly. I do it for four reasons. One, it is a sense of duty. Two, it is a pleasure. Three, because in doing so, I am paying my debt to the man who took time to pass it on to me. Four, because every time I do it, I take out a little more insurance for myself against a possible slip. Thank you for asking me to be here this evening."
Thank you, Deborah, so much for sharing your story with us. Now it is the time.